Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we have fetal pain, homelessness, a power plan, and much more. Joining me this morning in studio, Tribune Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner is here. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, environmental reporter Emma Penrod joins us. Emma, hello. And we have government and politics editor Dan Harry. I think this is 2 weeks in a row. Dan, thanks a lot.
Good morning.
And editorial writer George Pyle rounds out the panel. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories that are on your mind. You can put your comments online, sltrib.com, in the comment section of Behind the Headlines. You can tweet. The hashtag there is TribTalk. You can also call us. 801-355-TALK is the number. 801-355-8255. Let's start with some new laws. Utah got 356 new laws on the books this week. Among them is the so-called fetal pain law, and it's causing a bit of a stir. What does this law do, Dan Harry?
What the law does is it requires a physician, if they are performing an abortion on a woman, to give anesthesia to the fetus if it's after 20 weeks. And the idea behind it, as the legislature said, was they believe that a fetus can feel pain after that juncture. There's very little science that backs that up. And they had a parade of physicians coming up to the legislature and testifying that that's not the case, that they are putting them in an impossible dilemma because their first obligation is to practice medicine in the best interest of the patient. And they don't believe this is in the best interest of the patient. But if they do act in what they think is the best interest of the patient, they'll be breaking the law, and they could be prosecuted for it criminally.
Now, during the debate, the Utah Medical Association did get them to tweak the language a little bit to say that research may show instead of research does show that a fetus experiences pain. But doctors still really riled up about this and just trying to figure out how they can follow the law.
Well, and many of them say they can't. They just ethically cannot do it. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. I guess I would expect to see a legal challenge of this, because as far as we know, this is the first one in the country of this type of law. You know, there have been attempts in other states. There's been attempts in Congress. But so far, I guess we're out in front of the pack on this, and I don't know that that's where we want to be, but that's where we are.
I spoke with Senator Bramble, who did say that other states are exploring this, so it could be headed to the courts. George, proponents like Senator Bramble say, look, let's just err on the side of caution. We need, you know, we give pain meds to animals before they're euthanized, to death row inmates before they are put to death. We do this in utero fetal surgery, so why not err on the side of caution?
Well, they're practicing medicine without a license is what they're doing. Their doctors have told them this is either a dumb idea or an impossible idea. Somebody, I imagine, will file a lawsuit saying that the effect of this is to ban abortions after 20 weeks, which the Supreme Court will never stand for, Scalia's seat empty or not. Supreme Court will never go for that. I mean, there's a rash of these across the country while everybody's paying attention to the presidential race, you know, and we all should be watching Samantha Bee and have her explain to us why state legislatures are really important and elections for state legislatures are really important. And they, all over the country, they've been passing laws. I mean, Utah's is the only one about fetal pain, but there's all kinds of restrictions, and they're closing down clinics in Texas by forcing them to have hospital-like accommodations, which nobody in the medical profession says is necessary. So instead of just banning it, which they know the courts will never stand for, they're trying to find all kinds of ways around Roe versus Wade. And especially when they're purporting to know more about medicine and more about a specific area of medicine than the experts in the field do, you know, in the eyes of the editorial board, this is just unforgivable. There's just no rational basis for this at all, except their admitted position that they wish they could ban abortion. They can't, so they're trying to find alternate ways to accomplish the same thing.
Dan Harry, doctors are don't feel like they can comply with the law. How will the state enforce the law?
Well, that's to be seen. A lot of times you get into these kinds of issues and they're viewed as message bills and, you know, they don't really have an effect. But in this case, it could have a real effect. The number of cases are small. They're, you know, in the teens, generally speaking, in recent years where we've seen these abortions in the last 20 weeks. And some of them will fall into this area, as you mentioned, that they did. They tweaked the bill at the end, and there is some allowance for not following this law. But that's also in a very small number of cases. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, if there's a doctor that's not going to do this because they feel ethically bound not to do it, and they do perform one of these abortions, and it gets reported, I mean, it would have to be reported, right? It would have to be brought to the attention of authorities. But under this law, it certainly could be criminally prosecuted.
Hmm. Well, message bills certainly flourish in election years. So let's turn very briefly to election year politics. The June 28th primary, of course, is coming up. A new poll out this week is good news for Governor Gary Herbert. What are the numbers, Dan?
I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact numbers, but there's a huge gap. I think Jonathan Johnson was polling around 19% and the governor in the high 70s. And, you know, there has been this huge gap all along. The only time that the governor had anything near a close call was at the state Republican convention where Jonathan Johnson actually outpolled him among delegates and forced him into this primary. But once you get out into the general broader population, even among Republicans, the governor is extremely, extremely popular. It looks like he is, I mean, according to the polls now, he's headed to an easy reelection. The only thing that kind of casts a little bit of doubt on that is sort of his behavior reversing policies recently that he's taken a stand on previously. So there seems to be a little nervousness in the governor's camp, and that's very contrast with the polls.
So you're referring, of course, to his changing his tune on school testing, the SAGE test, right?
Right, and it's part of the whole Common Core debate. And, you know, the governor has tried to placate the conservative voices that have been calling that a federal mandate and calling for its end. He, you know, had the attorney general investigate some of these claims against it, and it got a clean bill of health. And, you know, he's stood by it all this time for several years. And now all of a sudden, the little pushing and shoving from his primary opponent, and he's ready to call it quits.
George, what do you make of that? Read the tea leaves for us.
Well, they got a scare at the convention, obviously. I mean, he'd already gathered the signatures to get on the ballot through the SB 54 route. So he was going to be on the ballot, the primary ballot, at the end of June. But he came in second at the convention. That's got to be a little scary, even though he knows as well as the rest of us that the people who show up at the convention are a very different sample than even registered Utah Republicans. Now, registered Utah Republicans as a group are going to be fairly conservative, but not off to the far, far right the way the delegates are. Now, and if this poll turns out to be accurate and he polls 78-80% in the primary, this should be absolute slam dunk proof that the convention delegates do not represent Utahns, do not represent Utah Republicans, do not represent politically active Utah Republicans. Whether this poll proves to be accurate will depend, as it always does, on turnout, who actually shows up at the polls, and that's probably why the governor's got posters and billboards all over the place. Why he's pulling these reversals on these programs, you can only think that it's because he lost the convention and that spooked him. Maybe he's got some other polling that we don't know about. Maybe he's just not leaving anything to chance, because the people who really hate Common Core and really hate SAGE testing are really going to hate it no matter what anybody says. People on the other side of that issue are really not all that hepped up about it. So you're not going to have this big outpouring of voters who come to the Republican primary in defense of Common Core. They're not, that's not what they're going to vote on. So I guess he just thinks he just can leave no stone unturned when it comes to sucking up to the right wing. But as we said, he's been, for years, he's been trying to tell us that there are no monsters under the bed. And now he's, okay, there's a monster under the bed. I'll kill it. I mean, even Greg Hughes, the Speaker of the House, there's a special session coming up to clean up some other things. And the governor made noises about how, oh, I know, on the special session, let's add a bill to do away with SAGE testing in the high school. And even Speaker Hughes, who has been known to kind of push things through at his whim, says, we're not going to make a decision like that, a big decision on the future of education policy, on a snap special session. We need to think about this.
More evidence of a very, very strange political journey this year. I don't want to linger on Donald Trump, but sadly, there is a Utah tie. So we'll just mention it briefly. Our Washington correspondent has... Thomas Burr has a piece in today's paper, sltrib.com. Donald Trump went to Capitol Hill yesterday. How did it go for Utah's delegation? Dan Harry.
Well, Orrin Hatch, who has for a little while now been saying that he can support Donald Trump and Republicans should unite behind him, kept up that tune and said that he would be willing to help Donald Trump in whatever way he can, because he's sure that he'll become more presidential as the election nears. On the other side, Mike Lee is noncommittal. He's not saying he's a never Trump person, but he's saying that the Donald Trump scares him.
Scares him to death.
Scares him to death. But that doesn't preclude him changing his mind in the future, as you know, we saw with our Representative Chris Stewart, who called Donald Trump our Mussolini. He is now behind our Mussolini and uniting behind the nominee.
Okay. To be continued. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll take a break. We'll be back in a minute. Stick around. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Joining me in studio today, Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, Jennifer Dobner, and George Pyle of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to join our conversation about the week's top stories, you can call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. Emma Penrod, let's turn to you. Rocky Mountain Power. We all rely on Rocky Mountain Power. It's pushing a new plan, a multi-state partnership to manage power. So what's the idea?
Yeah, so what has happened here? California has a surplus of renewable energy, and they have, their legislature has set a goal to have even more renewable energy. They need someone to use that renewable energy. So they have created this deal that would expand the ISO, as it is called, that currently runs their grid to run the grid for all of the western U.S. And Rocky Mountain Power has said, we think this is a good idea. We're looking at this. We might want to be a part of this. The fundamental idea here is that it would use economies of scale to reduce power prices across the West while also increasing access to renewables. You know, the solar energy production would peak in California at approximately the same time that power use peaks in Utah. So we could draw on their solar, and at the same time they could pull wind from, say, Wyoming or hydropower from Oregon, and therefore reduce their reliance on, you know, some of the fossil fuels that we continue to need to use.
So the upside, it's give and take, mm-hmm. it's access to renewables, and they say it's going to push consumer prices down.
Yes, okay. That is what they're saying.
Well, the plan has critics.
Yes.
So what are some of the concerns that you're hearing?
There are two primary concerns at this point, although there are many other concerns in addition to these. But the primary concerns are state sovereignty and how much is it going to cost to buy into this deal? As far as the sovereignty issue goes, this ISO is based in California. It is run by a board that is appointed by the California governor and the legislature. It was created by California law. So it is very much a California institution. And as things stand, it is the only institution in the area that is in question that is set up to take over and run this operation. They're the ones with the technology, with the expertise, with just what is necessary. So it looks like they will probably become the de facto management that would oversee the distribution of power in 11 Western states if California's plan, you know, pans out the way they would like it to. Mm.
Governor Herbert sent a letter to California Governor Jerry Brown. What did mm-hmm. that letter say?
Yeah, he was again very critical of this sovereignty issue and said he did not see that this would be beneficial to Utahns beneficial enough to Utahns to that they would be willing to give up our control over power distribution in Utah, which is currently overseen by Rocky Mountain Power.
Do we know if the California group is amenable to negotiation, to allowing the states to have a stake, a seat at the table?
I've talked to people at the ISO, and they are themselves. They say that if this were to go through, they would, you know, lobby for change, that everyone involved would have a seat at the table, and that they would change the governance of the ISO to make it more amenable to those in the group. On the other hand, the governor's letter was actually in response to, in response to a letter that was also sent by some California legislators to the governor of California, saying that they did not believe it would be right under any circumstances for them to use this expansion of the ISO to remove the state's sovereignty over its power policies, including their push for renewable energy. So both California and Utah and most of the other states involved at this point are all saying no one's going to give up any sovereignty to be involved in this deal.
A turf battle, George Pyle. I mean, it is early days, but we are seeing some early indications that there's some opposition to giving up that control. And, you know, do you think this is something that Utah should still pursue, this partnership idea?
Well, we're going to have to look at it. I mean, California is the tail that wags the dog in so many ways. It's if it were a separate country, somebody figured out, I think it would be like the world's fifth largest economy or something like that. It's also the unsung success story politically. I mean, Jerry Brown has really turned California around in the last few years. They have a budget surplus. They still have a lot of problems. They have a lot of problems with homelessness, they have a lot of problems with pollution, but it's been the success story. And when you're a success, you know, you kind of go around looking for other problems to fix. This is one of them. And of course, Utah doesn't want to be put in a situation where our power rates might go up. They're kind of low now, especially if it's a decision that somebody else gets to make. At the same time, the idea that you have sovereignty in electric power is kind of like the idea that you would have sovereignty in the supply of cornflakes. These are all national markets that the only way they're going to continue is to have broader grids like this. And if what Utah wants is to get authority so they can say, no, we don't want renewables, we want to burn more coal, well, there's no way California is going to stand for that, and there's no way any national authority or organization is going to stand for that, because everybody else is pushing renewables. This part of the reason for having this is that it would be a better way to use renewables, because you can move the power around when it's windy over here, you can put that power on the grid. When it's sunny over there, you can put that power on the grid, and everybody can share it. And you're not just in a situation where I would like to rely on solar power, but it's cloudy here today. Well, it's sunny somewhere else, and you can all share that.
There does seem, Emma, though, to be a fundamental incompatibility between Utah's policies and priorities and California's power policies and priorities. I mean, Utah is into coal mining. Utah likes oil and gas development. These are things that Californians find abhorrent.
Yes, and that's something that Rocky Mountain Power has recognized as a probable barrier to this deal. I was talking to one of their spokespeople, and they told me that's something that they're looking at, that they think this deal is a great idea, that they would love to go forward with it, that they see it as the way of the future. They just need all of the states to come together and play nice in the sandbox.
Good luck with that. Okay, well, we'll continue to follow the story. Another environmental story, I think it's in today's Tribune, sltrib.com. We will learn very soon more about the costs of a proposed Lake Powell pipeline.
Well, we will know more about a model that was developed to project what the cost might look like several years ago.
Okay.
But this model has become the subject of a sort of grandma fight, you know, where late last year, in the fall of last year, there was a University of Utah study released that found, you know, that the cost of the Lake Powell pipeline would be huge if it was actually paid for exclusively by Washington County and King County residents, as the law currently requires. The Washington County Water Conservancy District, when they saw this study, went to the media and told them that the study was false, and that they had their own model and their own study that could prove that this was false. And there were some numbers that were thrown around in some places. Other media were told, we don't have any numbers ready, but our model shows this study doesn't work. So the Utah Rivers Council, it's an advocacy group that has been opposing the pipeline for some time, filed a legal request to see this model. And the response to that was that the model didn't exist. So that has triggered this long sequence of appeals and hearings. And ultimately yesterday, the State Records Committee said the document appears to exist and ordered that it be released to the public.
Remind our listeners briefly, what is the Lake Powell Pipeline?
This is a long-running idea for a project that would build a pipeline between Lake Powell and Washington County and King County to deliver a portion of Utah's rights to the water in the Colorado River to Washington and King County for further growth. They're projected to run out of water, according to state estimates, in the next coming decades if their growth rate continues. So the idea is that they could pump water from Lake Powell over to the other side of the state, and it would provide water for the growth there.
Okay, and an open records win, but there is a chance that of an appeal, right?
Yes, they're still in a 30-day appeal process. Washington County Conservancy District has said they're going to wait for the official order, which should come in a week or so, and then they are going to talk with their consultant, kind of weigh their options, and see if they want to continue to appeal this.
Okay. While we're talking about transparency issues, can we move over to Utah Transit Authority? UTA scrutinized once again, this time for closing some of its meetings. And Dan Harry, what's the story?
Well, what makes this a really interesting story is the fact that UTA is in the midst of a big push for transparency. The board chairman, David Burton, has come out and said, we got the message from the last election when voters in Salt Lake and Utah counties voted down a proposal to increase sales taxes for transit and transportation. And they have acknowledged that's largely because of public distrust of UTA. So in the wake of that, UTA has been making some changes, and I would say, you know, some good faith changes about making their operations more open to the public, inviting more public comment, you know, doing away with really sky-high bonuses for executives, and creating new policies for travel that would be more open to scrutiny by the public. So they've been doing all these great things, and they've been promoting these great things as saying, we're doing this because we recognize we need to build public trust. It's not where it needs to be for us to succeed. And in the midst of this, they quietly, out of the spotlight, close all of these subcommittee meetings. And they don't really have a very good reason for it. You know, their overarching reason is, oh, well, we're making more decisions in a full board meeting, so we don't really need these open meetings of the smaller groups of board members. The lamest excuse that they gave just the other day was, well, nobody from the public really attends these meetings. Well, our transportation reporter, Lee Davidson, attends a lot of those meetings, and he's representing the public there. He goes there so he can report what they do to the public, you know? So
essentially, UTA is saying these meetings aren't that important, and no one is there anyway.
Right.
So that's our justification
for... The public doesn't show up is the lamest of all excuses because, you know, if you go to a lot of... city council meetings, which I sometimes do, and you go to, you know, other planning commission meetings and other government meetings, a lot of times the public doesn't show up. But that's why we're there, so that the public can know what's going on.
So the critics are lining up, and this includes Governor Herbert. What did he have to say about this?
Well, Governor Herbert, and we'll say this came after Jonathan Johnson criticized the UTA. So, you know, I don't know how this all plays in. There's an election going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, the governor was very critical, and he said there's no excuse for them doing this. You know, Jim DeBacchus was a usual hyperbolic self and called it arrogance on steroids and called for the mass resignation of all board members. But yeah, then there were some other critics as well. So it has not gone over well. It did not fade quietly into that night as the UTA apparently had hoped it would, because they never announced this policy. They just didn't post agendas for these meetings. And Lee Davidson called and said, where are your agendas? And that's when he found out, yeah, they're not going to post those agendas. They're not allowing the public into the meetings.
No more agendas. George Pyle. So opposition is building. Will UTA bow to public pressure this time?
I would think so. I would think they need to try and find some face-saving way to say, oops, we're sorry. We didn't mean to shut the public out of these meetings. And technically, the final decisions on important things are or should be made in the open meeting of the full board. But the way the committee system works is the committee studies an issue, considers it for a long period of time, makes a recommendation. So that on a lot of issues, that's where the work is done. That's where the conversations, not debates necessarily, but conversations take place. And then when the committee reports to the full board, unless there's some problem somewhere, they tend to say, I accept the committee's recommendation. That's why we have the committee. If those are closed, then the idea of why did you make this recommendation? What's in it for you? Is there some kind of ulterior motive? Is there some kind of development deal going on? The public isn't open to that. The public doesn't have a chance to see that. Now, the executive director's position of UTA is open right now, and with the amount of money they seem to have to throw around, they should have just about their pick of anybody they want to come and run the UTA. I would hope that high on their list of qualifications would be somebody who's really good at understanding public agencies should be open and transparent for the public's good, for their own good, and especially in a situation like this where they need the support of the public to pass tax increases, they need the support of the legislature to authorize various things, they need the support of various county governments and city governments to set their routes. They need a lot of public support, and they seem to think that because they're the only public transit agency, there's no competing public transit agency that you can go ride instead, that they don't have to do these things. But they need public support, and they're going to have to change the way they operate if they're going to get it.
Dan Harry, do we know the status of that executive director search?
They tell us they're getting close, but we don't have any kind of time frame for when that's going to be announced.
As of now, these meetings are closed. Our open records guru, Jeff Hunt, says, really not okay according to the open meetings law. So is a court challenge in the offing?
Well, it's possible. No one's come forward with that yet. And some people have made the comparison with the legislature. The legislature closes its Republican caucus meetings, and they do a lot of the discussion and deliberation in there. There's one big difference with the UTA situation. The legislature, who obviously writes the open meetings law, has excluded their caucuses specifically from the open meetings law. UTA has no such cover on this. So, I think if there is a legal challenge, I'm not an attorney, but I deal with a lot of open meetings issues. I think this is a losing case for them. And, like George says, you would think with all the critics out there, including the governor of the state, that they might reconsider this position.
Mm. We will continue to follow it at sltrib.com. Let's turn to the ever-growing case of former Utah Attorneys General John Swallow and Mark Shurliff. Those cases are pending, but there's a significant sidebar that developed this week. The Davis County Attorney, Troy Rawlings, has a theory about an element of the case. Jennifer Dobner, explain. What's his hunch?
How much time do we have?
Okay, sure.
If by theory you mean his intention here is that he's looking into unanswered questions related to what the federal government did or didn't do when they were initially looking at Shurliff and Swallow back in 2012 and 2013, that's what he's doing. And
so some of their behaviors raised question marks for him.
Well, the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Utah, and the Department of Justice PIN, which is their public integrity section in Washington, D.C., in 2013, both either recused or said they weren't going to pursue any criminal charges. And that triggered an ongoing investigation that involved Salt Lake County District Attorney Sim Gill and Davis County Attorney Troy Rawlings, which resulted in the state charges that where we are today, Shurliff and Swallow both charged with multiple felonies. And those cases are split now, and of course, Sim Gill's office is prosecuting Swallow and Rawlings' office is prosecuting Shurliff. Rawlings has unanswered questions about what DOJ PIN decided, what the U.S. Attorney's Office here decided, why they didn't pursue, why the FBI continued to work, to be allowed to work with state prosecutors in order to pursue things that led to criminal charges. So it appears like there's a wider conspiracy afoot. He's not saying for sure what evidence he has at this point, but he does want a state grand jury to hear the evidence that's been gathered and for a grand jury to decide whether or not there should be criminal indictments.
Grand juries are secretive.
They are.
What does it take to call a grand jury?
So it's a very rarely used process in Utah, and typically we don't find out about these things until after the fact, and sometimes not at all, because by law they are secret. So to get a grand jury, there's two routes. One is anybody in the public who believes that there's a need for a grand jury can appear before a panel of judges, a public panel of judges, which they meet, I can't remember how many times a year, like three times a year, I think, to consider these things. That's one route. But if you're a prosecutor, you can just appeal directly to the panel in a letter. So that's what we believe Rawlings is. I mean, he said he's seeking a grand jury. So he'll take this to a panel of five judges. They're judges from across the state. They'll decide whether they think he has sufficient grounds to warrant a grand jury. If they do, then they will impanel between 9 and 15 citizens, and that would be the jury. And then they would have a series of hearings. I don't think you could do it in one sitting. I would think over a couple of days, in which witnesses would be subpoenaed to testify under oath about all of these questions. Who decided they couldn't prosecute or wouldn't prosecute Swallow and Shurliff? Who decided?
You said Troy Rawlings is not talking about the evidence that he's gathered,
mm-hmm.
but clearly he believes that he's built a case Do we have any sense of what would lead him to believe that there are legitimate claims here?
Well, we do, because there's a paper trail of or a trail of breadcrumbs, if you will, scattered throughout various court documents in the Shurtleff case, in the pursuit of in his pursuit of information that he believes has to be disclosed in order for Shurtleff to defend himself under the law, and also in the Jeremy Johnson federal case. And Jeremy Johnson, of course, is a St. George businessman who was a contributor to both Shurtleff and Swallow, who started raising many of these questions in the course of his own prosecution by the U.S. Attorney's Office. It makes my head swim. There are so many little details and facts to keep track of. But so what we know is Rawlings has questions about the DOJ PIN and the allegations from Jeremy Johnson that John Swallow helped initiate an effort in 2010 to bribe U.S. Senator Harry Reid. We know that there are questions about the connections between John Swallow and a U.S. attorney named Brent Ward, and the decision making that whether that relationship influenced some decision making to either prosecute or not prosecute. We know that there are questions about, also raised by Jeremy Johnson, about election improprieties related to Senator Mike Lee's campaign in 2010, and whether or not money was being inappropriately funneled, you know, from one person through straw donors to Lee's campaign, also potentially other campaigns.
We're talking power brokers.
Right.
Senator Reid.
Right.
Senator Lee.
Right.
I mean, he must feel like he's got something there, or else he wouldn't be talking about it.
And he's you know, mostly talking about it through documents and statements and documents. But he has acknowledged to us on the record that he does believe that there are unanswered questions. He's pursued a lot of information that he believes the FBI and DOJ PIN may have withheld. I mean, that fight started almost a year ago, publicly in a press conference, and then through a series of court filings, which lead us to today, or well, actually to February, when all of a sudden a whole, you know, like six terabytes of data showed up that he never had before. So something's going on, and we're trying to get at sort of what's going on behind, what has gone on behind the scenes that lead us to this point. Now, this, of course, has slowed down the prosecution of Mark Shurtleff.
And interestingly, you reported that Mark Shurtleff is supportive of this inquiry. He wants a grand jury.
He does want a grand jury. And here's what we know about that is that we know that three times Shurtleff himself spoke with the FBI about some of these allegations, presumably because he had information that was concerning to him, as his attorneys have said they didn't pass his smell test. And we don't see anything came of it. And so we know that he will be a witness in this grand jury, and that he presumably has things that he's willing to say under oath. How that affects the, you know, his own prosecution remains to be seen.
If you missed the story, it's well-researched and lengthy, sltrib.com, for all the details. You mentioned Jeremy Johnson, and a little bit of news on his case. That I guess he's got a new sentencing date this week. What came out this week?
Well, they've moved his sentencing date from June to July. He represented himself during his 6-week federal trial.
Does he have lawyers now?
He does have lawyers now, and they are helping him. You know, he was convicted of lying to banks in some credit card processing applications for his St. George online marketing company. He has lawyers helping him fight that conviction. They've raised a number of questions about some of the evidence, and there's a big fight going on over how much time he should actually spend in prison. The federal government says up to 34 years. Johnson's attorneys say 0 to 6 months. That's a huge discrepancy. They've argued that the judge needs an evidentiary hearing to consider that more thoroughly. So they've put off a sentencing date, presumably so they can maybe work these things out in the interim. But he will, I would expect, also figure to be quite prominent in terms of being a witness in any sort of grand jury proceeding, since much of this stuff that we're talking about here stems from questions that he raised, including, you know, negotiating a plea agreement with the federal government that would have excluded John Swallow from any prosecution.
Complicated stuff, but well done on the reporting. We need to take another break. We are talking about Utah's top stories, but we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. One other story I want to hit on quickly is some new data showing a sharp uptick in homelessness in Utah. Dan Harry, what are the numbers?
Well, the numbers are kind of startling in light of the fact that all we hear is how great Utah's economy is. Every few days we see a new rating or press release saying that we're top job growth in the nation and, you know, we're best managed state, this and that. But the state's own data now shows that while all this was going on, all these great things economically, we still have a very severe and growing homelessness problem. Homelessness last year grew 7% overall, according to the state data, and 17% among families.
And it's not just a Salt Lake City problem. Yeah. The data shows that it's regional.
Statewide.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes, in the public mind, a Salt Lake City problem because that's where most of the services are. That's where the big shelter is. That's where the big free clinic is. And that's where a lot of homeless people come, some of them to try to find work, some of them to panhandle and socialize, and some of them to buy drugs or sell drugs. But yeah, it's statewide, and it's actually growing, according to state data, more in like Utah, Summit, and Wasatch counties at a higher rate than it is in Salt Lake County.
So what is going on? Why is this occurring?
Well, the workplace services told us that one of the reasons is housing. The cost of housing is just keeps increasing. And, you know, that's part of the function, I guess, of a growing economy, too, is rents are going up along with house prices and values. And it just prices a lot of folks out of being able to pay rent. If you're making minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour, and you're, let's say, a single mother, which is, you know, the case in many of these families, you can maybe make a decision about whether you're going to pay rent or whether you're going to buy food. That's not a position anybody should be put in, but that's the reality of it. You know, there are ways that the government provides to help. There are food pantries, and there are food stamps, and there are other programs. But still, it's awfully tough out there, especially, like I said, when there's a lack of affordable housing and when rents are really going up.
State legislature, of course, allocated a lot of money, many millions. But is that going to tackle the affordable housing issue?
No, it's not. And it's going to take several years. I mean, they put the legislature appropriated. They approved. $9.25 million this year, with promises that similar amounts would come in the next couple of years. But yeah, that's not going to solve the problem. It can certainly help. A lot of that's going to be used towards new shelters, smaller shelters, dividing different populations, like trying to separate women and children from single homeless men, which is, you know, a really good idea, I think, and services. But, yeah, that tackling that affordable housing issue is a tough one. It's a long-term problem.
We'll continue to follow this. If you want more detail, again, sltrib.com. We'll go to our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Jennifer Dobner, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I don't know that it's underplayed because it's just coming out today, but the ACLU is pushing Salt Lake City Police to release a video of a shooting that involved a 17-year-old young man, Abdi Muhammad, in February down by the homeless shelters. We don't have a lot of information about what actually happened that night, and the fact that they're getting involved is kind of interesting, I think.
The body cam video.
Yeah, we'll see what it tells us.
Absolutely. Emma Penrod?
Yeah, so I've got another one on the environment beat here. There has been another lawsuit filed, this one by Oil and Gas Trade Association, challenging the latest decision on the sage-grouse. So if we remember, the sage-grouse was up for listing under the Endangered Species Act. That listing was denied on the grounds that there was going to be this federal plan that would be worked out and that the bird would be protected by other means. And now there's just been a whole slew of lawsuits on both sides, people who wanted it listed, people who didn't want it listed. It's maybe a classic case of a compromise that made no one happy.
The latest installment of the sage-grouse dilemma. Check it out, sltrib.com. Dan Harry?
Well, I don't know that this story has been underplayed, but it's just coming out, and it's a profile of Paul Huntsman, the presumed new owner of the Salt Lake Tribune. And if you go to sltrib.com, you'll see it now. So it's a well-written story and well worth reading. It reveals some things about an individual who has not really been a public figure.
Can you give us one fun fact about Paul Huntsman?
Fun fact, he's a marathon runner.
Ah, okay. All right, more, sltrib.com. George Pyle, what is your pick today?
Well, that was going to be mine because it just broke on the website just since we've been sitting here.
I want to read it.
Yeah, the bad news, George, is that you're going to have to become a marathon runner now.
I guess so. Okay, hack rider dead at 59. That's the headline. No, Paul was in to see us a couple of weeks ago. He went around, shook everybody's hand, said nice things about everybody, or maybe knowing things about everybody that left us guessing. The article this morning does specify that, in case there was any doubt, the paper is not being bought by Huntsman Inc. It's not being bought by Huntsman Chemical. It's not being bought by John Jr., John Sr. It's being bought by Paul Huntsman himself, his own money, in the same way that Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. Amazon didn't buy it. He did. It's his puppy, and now it's his problem.
We're going to read that profile very carefully in the newsroom. I know that people in the public are also very interested. On that note, though, Dan, do we know when the deal will be done and Paul Huntsman will officially be the owner of the Trib?
I asked this question from some editors yesterday, and, Terry Orm, the editor. And, you know, he doesn't know for sure. He just keeps saying soon. So they have a fairly tight deadline coming up here. And, you know, I'm guessing that...
the rumors were that it would be today.
There were some throwing around the date of the 15th as some sort of deadline. But I'm not sure that's true or whether that was an artificial one. But I think it'll be soon.
Okay, stay tuned if you're interested and intrigued like we are. Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, Jennifer Dobner, George Pyle, all of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Thank you.
And we're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby talks plane rides.
It's in the news lately it's been in the news a lot, about how people are having more and more meltdowns on airplanes because air travel is so frustrating.
Do you think that's what it is?
Well, I think it's also the fact that human beings are not taking their right meds. But yeah, we've become accustomed to instant gratification, and air travel is something that requires a certain degree of patience, and not everybody has that.
You were involved... participated in an altercation on a plane
in Seattle.
Tell us, read a little bit of this column that you wrote.
This I wrote just a few years ago, back in 2011. A few years ago, I was involved in a minor altercation on an airplane in Seattle. I didn't start it. I merely offered some advice. As we were boarding the plane, a 20-something woman was yakking away on her cell phone. A female flight attendant asked her to end the call. The woman ignored her. During the final button-up procedures, the woman was told several times to hang up. She didn't. Finally, the flight attendant leaned over and, in a voice laced with steel, said, "Hang up now, or we'll have to put you off." Several other passengers immediately offered to help throw the woman off the plane after a brief instructional beating. Me, "Yeah, but let's take off first." Attendant, "Please be quiet, sir." I shut up. "Hey, I don't mess with people, including really small grandma-looking flight attendants, upon whom my life may depend for several hours."
You have great respect for those who fly and are willing to put up with people for, you know, 3-4 hours at a time.
You bet. I do. I mean, flight attendants, I could not do their job. I'd hurt somebody in the first, you know, two flights. We're rude. We're impatient. We're easily offended, and we're poorly medicated.
And you also support them using force if need be.
Oh, yeah, you bet. One of my favorite things to do is to get onto YouTube and watch people being thrown off airplanes, you know, for poor
behavior. Videos of that?
Oh, yeah. They're hilarious. Sometimes, you know, you feel bad because the person is clearly having a psychotic break. You know, it's not their fault. But there are other people out there, drunks and bossy people, and who think they, you know, deserve something that they don't or whatever. And the police called, get on the airplane, drag them down the aisle, and everybody on the airplane is clapping. You know, get this bum off so we can go.
So you are well-behaved when you go on a flight.
Oh, you're damn right. Yeah. I know. Flying is stressful for me because I'm claustrophobic. So when I hear those doors thunk shut, I stop being afraid about whether or not the plane's going to crash, and I start being afraid about if it won't, because I just want out.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Again, find all the Kirby archives on the website, sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Bennett Purser and Jessica Sonderegger at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.